This is Transparency, a podcast by Gender Dysphoria Alliance, hosted by Aaron Kimberly and Aaron Terrell. Each week, we'll be joined by people who have personal or professional experience with gender dysphoria and physical transition. We'll also discuss how our trans experiences relate to the concept of gender identity. Join us for a compassionate yet heterodox approach to the question of trans. Helen Pluckrose is a political and cultural writer and commentator, addressing current affairs from a liberal humanist perspective. Her particular focus is on critical social justice, aka woke, scholarship and activism. Helen took part in the Grievance Studies Affair, along with Peter Boghossian and James Lindsay, which submitted shoddy, ridiculous, and ideologically biased papers to academic journals known for publishing critical social justice scholarship. In 2020, she co-authored Cynical Theories with James Lindsay, which traced the evolution of postmodern thought into critical social justice scholarship. In that same year, she co-founded Counterweight, an organization for helping individuals push back at authoritarian critical social justice policies and training programs at their place of work, university, or child school. Helen continues to work with individuals and organizations to resist ideological capture. Helen really just wants you to value evidence-based epistemology and consistently liberal principles. On a side note, I have to apologize for my audio in this episode. I thought I could use just the mic inbuilt into my AirPods, but when I went to go back and edit the conversation, I learned how very wrong I was. So again, my apologies, it will not happen again. And here's our conversation with, Helen Pluckrose. Welcome back to Transparency. I'm Aaron Terrell. He is Aaron Kimberly, and we are very, very delighted to have Helen Pluckrose with us today. Thanks so much for being here, Helen.
Oh, it's lovely to be here, both of you, Aarons.
Welcome, Helen.
You are the co-author of one of my favorite books, or probably my favorite book on the kind of current culture, understanding the current culture that we find ourselves in. I read it just a few months ago, and it kind of blew my mind. Just kind of the history of postmodernism as like this niche academic philosophy, and then its recent kind of takeover of, you know, progressive, just like kind of progressive mainstream, essentially, over the years. If you want to talk about a bit about that book, the inspiration for it, the reception, maybe that's a good place to start, I think.
No, well, Cynical Theories sort of comes from working backwards, essentially. I was doing my degree and sort of looking into postmodernism as a form in itself. At the same time, about 15 years ago, at the same time as the activism on behalf of women, on behalf of LGBT people, was starting to shift. And we were seeing some really authoritarian activism coming in that held that had some very particular ideas about knowledge, power, and language, and that knowledge really was a cultural construct, that the powerful got to decide which knowledge was legitimate and which wasn't. They provided the way to speak about it, and then power is perpetuated by everybody by speaking in these terms. And of course, there is truth to that, because culture exists. We all know culture exists. It influences the way we see things and how we talk about things. But this really precise activism, which holds that absolutely everybody is socialized into white supremacy, into patriarchal views, into homophobic views, into transphobic views, into all of these other views, and that we cannot help but speak about it, and as though objective reality is really absolutely unobtainable, that we can know almost nothing at all about it, or if we can, what is interesting is how the knowledge got culturally constructed, how the powerful got to present this view of knowledge. And so this was quite clearly the same set of ideas that is in postmodernism. And as I've tracked the scholarship back, it's very, very clear that it is. So the most cited theorist at the moment is Michel Foucault. And this is happening because he runs straight through all the main, what I would call critical social justice theories and other people would call woke, The theories of race, theories of sexuality, theories of gender, theories of disability, fatness, colonialism, they run through everything, right through to what I would call today current critical social justice activism. So you can trace that backwards. So cynical theories, it starts with the original postmodernists, with one chapter just outlining the key ideas. Then it goes into the next wave between the 90s and 2010, and then the current activism, but really it started at the end with the activism we see now, and then tracing the citations back to their source. And it is astonishing the degree to which it is Michel Foucault, just as Augustine can be really convincingly argued to underlay so many of Western ideas in both philosophy and religion. Foucault is to be found in the critical social justice scholarship right now. But whereas as he was against meta-narratives and he was against holding anything as true, as the evolution has occurred, we are now in a state where we are making truth assertions and trying to build a new meta-narrative and impose that knowledge on other people in direct contravention of what Foucault had actually argued for. So yes, that was a rather waffly explanation.
No, that was great. So basically, yeah, you're like, how did we get here? And then, yeah, the backwards trajectory kind of filled in that all those gaps. And yeah, Foucault is the through line. Just for anyone listening, could you explain meta narratives for the audience?
Yeah, so a meta-narrative is kind of a theory of everything. So Christianity could be said to be a meta-narrative because it tells us why we're here, what we're meant to do, both morally and ethically, what the end story is. It kind of covers everything. And it's this big overarching narrative. And this was, and Marxism as well, this was something that the original postmodernists reacted very strongly against because Marxism had this very straight sort of the, take control of the means of production, distribute wealth equally, and everything will be fine. This is this very sort of simple narrative, and the postmodernists came out in the late 60s saying, no, there are lots of mini narratives. We don't know how true any of them are. We do know that some of them have been prioritized over others, white Western masculine ways of knowing. So we need to get all the mini narratives out and have people present their own knowledge, their own experience, and have these recognized as part of the whole. So they've opposed any grand narratives, as Lyotard called them. But of course, I would argue, and most liberal rationalists, empiricists would argue, is that what really is important about any narrative is how good it is at explaining what is true. So, if, say, the theory of evolution by natural selection provides a cohesive explanation for a great number of different things all across the field of biology, this doesn't make it automatically suspect if its basis is true, if this is actually a true representation of why some animals work the way they do, why we have certain traits, certain organs. This would not be a problem that it was a, it all fits into a large theory or meta-narrative, as long as that is true. So that skepticism that scientists, that empiricists have, where we say, how do we know this is true? And then we try to discover whether it is or isn't true, is a much more productive one. Within science, we're never too sure of having obtained the truth. All knowledge is provisional. Things are constantly trying to be falsified. This is this humble kind of skepticism. But within the meta narratives that have formed from a postmodern opposition to meta narratives, we have lived experience in certain theories and activist stances, which must just be taken as too true and seen as unquestionable. So there's a lack of humility there. There's an ideological bias running through it.
I guess one tangible example would be, in a pluralistic society like we live in, that there was a separation of church and state, where people are protected to have their religion and believe in that worldview, but not to impose it on the general public of non-believers. but we're seeing an imposition of other worldviews that aren't substantiated by evidence being codified into law, and so there's no separation between those worldviews and state.
Yes, exactly. That's a very important point, and the concept of secularism is something that I think it's really important to understand, because it's not relativism. When we say that Christians, Jews, Muslims, and atheists may all exist, we're not saying that Jesus is the son of God, that he's a holy prophet, that he's a false prophet, and that he probably never existed all at once. We're not claiming all those things are true. We are protecting the right to believe all of those things, for people to argue for them if they want to, not to have to if they don't want to, and for none of this to have any role in institutions or to be imposed on anybody else. And that is, I think, precisely what we need to do with other ideologies. You captured it perfectly when you said you have the right to believe this, but not to impose it on anyone else. That is where that line has to be: protecting beliefs, protecting speech, protecting people's non-harmful lifestyles and the way that they choose to live, until it gets to a point where it causes material harm to someone else, or it prevents them from living in the way that it feels right to them.
And so, right, somehow, currently today, we have a kind of absurd meta-narrative that's ironically, I guess, become a meta-narrative in that it is a queer theory, which is kind of completely incoherent and intentionally incoherent, and yet it's also been dogmatized. Do you want to talk about a bit about that and how that happened?
Yeah, so the point of queer theory, as you say, is that it is to dispense with all meta-narratives. And Foucault talks about this, Judith Butler does as well. She warns, even in Gender Trouble, that we should not take queer theory as a meta-narrative, because then it will become an oppressive one and be imposed upon people. But then, of course, when that has it actually happened, then a very confusing thing happened, where trans activists said, no, let me go back to what queer theory is. The idea underlining it is much, much simpler than people imagine, given the obscurity and the denseness of the language, which is that people are oppressed because we have constructed categories of male, female, masculine, feminine, heterosexual, homosexual. And then we have tried to police people to fit into masculine man attracted to women and feminine women attracted to men. And the way to oppose this is to break down those categories and to let and in that way, the people who don't fit into any of them will not be conditioned or policed into doing so. And of course, the liberal approach to acceptance of people who fell outside those categories is the equivalent of "some people are gay, get over it." So we can understand that there is great individual variability in humans, and that some people will fit very neatly into a majority position, being typically feminine or masculine, being attracted to the same sex rather than the opposite sex, and some people won't, and that we don't actually need to moralize about this. And we can just accept that variety to exist. But for the queer theorists, they really want a more radical approach, in which we just dissolve absolutely everything. So that was the status in the queer theory stand, right between 1990 2010. But then, as trans activism has arisen, it no longer wants to break down these barriers so much, and these categories, but it wants to have people to choose which ones they belong to, and have this be definitive. So when we get the statement "trans women are women," which is made just as an assertion, this is the opposite of what you would expect from queer theory, because this is then putting people who are biologically male but have a strong sense of themselves as female or a woman into the category of woman. It's upholding that category, but changing the rules about who can be in it and who can't. And so when this, because Judith Butler in particular, she argued that gender and sexuality, that they are essentially performative. We perform our gender in different situations, which of course we do. The way that you are sort of feminine or masculine with your mother is probably very different to the way that you are with somebody you're attracted to. But this is taken to a huge extreme, and it makes there no reality to it exist at all. No gendered traits, which are caused by the evolution of our brains, no impact from hormones. It's all a very much a performance. So when trans activists have said to Judith Butler, if you are saying we are all performative, then this means that trans people don't really exist, to which she responded quite unsatisfactorily. I never meant to say that trans people didn't exist, but has not really ever explained how her theories of performativity and the authentic identity of trans people can coexist at the same time, which of course they actually can't.
Yeah, and one of the crisis that we're seeing within the LGBT community, related to that is, we've kept adding letters to this now very long, well, almost every letter of the alphabet represented in the LGBTQ two spirit intersex, and what we've lost is the ability to advocate for ourselves as individual letters in that alphabet. Because we've all been force teamed together as this community aligned under the banner of queer theory. It's really the Q that's defining and defining and representing every other letter of that alphabet, to the queering of intersex people who have a medical condition, to applications of that to every other letter, including homosexuals. I think what Foucault was saying was that the delineation of a homosexual, the category of a homosexual, was really only for the purpose of oppressing homosexuals. I think what it failed to take into account is that you have to clearly identify a group of people in order to advocate for that group of people. So whether it's lesbians as a distinct class being able to advocate for themselves, or intersex people as a distinct category advocating for themselves. And we've lost that ability by trying to blur and erase the delineations between all of those groups.
Yes, I think one ideology has tried to take over a lot of identities belonging to people who could be considered sexual minorities, gender minorities, that the people who are united only really in that they get the same kind of backlash from social conservatives. That's the cluster. That's where you're not conforming to gender roles, gender stereotypes, to heterosexual norms, and therefore you are this kind of problem. That's where I think the cluster has come from, and I do think that these different groups can make common cause against that particular enemy, but as distinct entities in themselves, there isn't a natural relationship between being attracted to somebody of the same sex and having a sense of yourself as being a different gender to that's suggested by your genitalia. That these aren't the same kind of thing, and where asexuality fits in is not entirely clear either. So I think yes, people trying to push queer theory into all of this doesn't work, because the vast majority of people on every one of those levels is not actually a queer theorist, does not believe in the tenets of that. For the vast majority of people, the old liberal premise of just let people be individuals, and if they're not hurting you, leave them alone, really does work.
You mentioned before we started, was it gender ideologies? Do you want to talk a bit about which, like, what are the different ideologies you've identified? I think we just kind of touched on a couple of them there. But yeah, if you want to go into that theory.
Yeah, so if we are looking at, obviously, as Kathleen Stock has identified, four different meanings of the word gender that are in common usage. But if we are looking at gender as, say, the adjective that can go with the noun of sex that we have always had. So if gender is masculine or feminine, whereas sex is male or female, And the sentence, she is a very masculine woman, makes intuitive sense to you. You already have this sense of gender, and we do. It goes back from centuries. I frequently quote St. Augustine, right in the early days of Christianity, and his reference to manly, his mother's manly faith, his own womanly tears. He's not saying anybody has changed sex here. He's identifying traits and behaviors which are more common to one sex than another. So he was identifying assertiveness as more common to men, and emotional expression is more common to women, and those things. So if we accept that gender in that sense of psychological and behavioral differences that exist between men and women on average because of the work different pressures that their brains have evolved under and the different hormones that their bodies process, then we have a sense of gender which we can say has gone back, that humans have been observing and talking about pretty consistently for as long as there is writing. If we have gender identity, a sense that somebody has that this sex that my body is does not feel right. It just, if somebody says I'm a man and yes, I have a penis, but this feels wrong in some way, then this is something that is much more, I think, subjective. I'm sure there are a number of causes for it, and what we need above everything at the moment is empirical researchers looking into that so that they can assist people in the way they need to be assisted to live their best lives. But this concept of gender identity, as it's understood now, is really comes down to this is an innate essence that lives inside each person, and it is more definitive of them being a man or a woman and than their biological sexes. And so we have to go with that on in every situation, including those in which their biological sex is actually more relevant. So, for example, in sports. So that gender identity ideology is based on that belief that a person's self-identified gender identity really makes them a man or a woman, and that they must be accepted as such in every situation by everyone. And not to do so is to be transphobic and bigoted against a minority group. There are no justifiable exceptions to that. Then the other, I mean, one of the longest standing gender ideologies is gender essentialism, which comes from the sort of socially conditioned, the socially conservative standpoint, which says that men need to be men and they need to be attracted to women, and anything else is degeneracy and possibly Marxism. You know, this one. So this is when they say you are a man, therefore you will be tough, you will be strong, you will not be emotionally expressive, you will provide, you will be interested in all of these things, and you will be sexually attracted to women. That's it. And you have the same thing with the women. And this is what feminists have typically objected to, because the gender essentialist roles for women have had that they need to be subservient, they are more emotional, less rational, that they need to be cared for by men, that their main job is being domestic goddesses and reproducing children. Their role is as the mother. So feminists have objected to gender essentialism, gender stereotypes, gender roles, and now a great number of them object to gender identity on that same belief. So that brings us over to the gender critical, which I would say is that the third gender ideology that is out there. And gender critical at its root, a lot of people who call themselves gender critical now simply mean that they object to authoritarian forms of trans activism. They don't mean that they are radically skeptical that gender is at all a real thing. They are quite likely to call themselves gender critical while still believing that there are psychological, behavioural, cognitive differences between men and women on average. So, but the gender critical feminism coming from the radical feminism has a real blank slatist view. It seems to believe that evolution stopped at the neck, that all differences and disparities that are seen between men and women in the different choices they make, the different jobs they take up, the different attitudes towards casual sex, their different ways of communication. They are all socially conditioned, and so when they say they want to abolish gender, and they're radically skeptical of gender, they mean that they want to remove all of these social roles, the gender roles, gender stereotypes, which they see as oppressing women, mostly in the service of patriarchy, in order to then free women from the burden of having to be submissive and family orientated and generally do what men say. But while they're doing that, they are essentially saying things which are not true, and this is why I call them the three gender ideologies: gender identity, gender essentialism, and gender critical. The gender identity as an ideology is the one that says this innate sense of self is definitive, and it makes people. We need to put people in that category in every situation. There is no reason not to do that. It ignores evidence that actually people with male bodies who've been through male puberty really are much stronger and faster and more physically dense, that they are a danger to women if they're going to collide with them on the sports pitch, that the majority of sex offenders are male and heterosexual, and women are the primary targets. So this is a danger if they're getting put in the same prisons, sex offenders being put in. So this kind of thing, this is where that falls down on truth. Gender essentialists are quite clearly falling down on truth, because their claim that everybody does fit into this box of masculine man attracted to women and feminine women attracted to men is simply untrue. That is demonstrably false, and trying to force people into it would just make a lot of people unhappy and never really works. And then gender critical, if it's radically skeptical that gender exists at all, that any behavioral, cognitive, psychological differences exist or explain anything, then this also goes against many very well replicated studies in the field of psychology and sort of behavioral sciences. So these are the three ideologies that can get in the way of important things like working out how to accommodate trans people in society without taking away any women's spaces, women's sports, how to treat gender distressed children. Without coming down on one ideology and trying to diagnose them as just immediately trans. So that these are the things that can get in the way of that, and try and push laws and social expectations and treatments for children in directions which take them further away from the truth.
It seems like a good segue to your inclusion into GenSpect. And so I would love to hear what your role is within the organization in relation to their mandate.
So I'm as GenSpec, it's important to understand that I am an advisor to GenSpec and not a representative. So I do not have any qualifications in understanding gender distress itself or gender dysphoria, and I do not advise on how this should be done. I come from a position of understanding queer theory, of understanding authoritarian trans activism, institutional capture by these ideologies in particular, and as a liberal proponent of pluralism and the free speech belief. And the right to live as one sees fit, as long as it is not harming anybody else, and we have to notice when it's harming other people. So I'm coming from this angle. GenSpect will call on me when it wants to understand any aspect of queer theory which is not within the remit of a therapist, medical people, and anybody dealing with gender dysphoria. I can advise them on that if they want to. Put out something that the last piece that we wrote, in which Stella and I wrote, in which is why we're going to avoid political ideological bias. That was a statement there saying that everybody is welcome. They want input from absolutely everybody throughout all of the ideologies of gender. They must be able to speak because there is almost certainly truth in all of them, but they're not going to let research be biased by any of them. And the best way to do that, because we're each of us is very good at arguing for whatever we already believe, as Jonathan Haidt points out. And trying to be unbiased is really it's a losing game. You should still try, obviously, because it's much better when you try than when you don't try. But the only way that we can realistically make sure that we are looking at all questions, that everything will be critiqued, is to bring people with opposing ideas together and to allow all of them to critique each other's ideas so that what is true can emerge as a product of these different ideas coming together. So that is what Stella and I tried to encapsulate in the last essay for Genspect, in which we were trying to say to people, we are not wanting to push anybody out or silence anybody, but we cannot have anybody silencing anybody else, or it just won't be fit for purpose because there are so many ways to gender dysphoria, gender distress. There needs to be a lot of ways of looking at it as well. And obviously, these need to be evidence-based ways. We don't want anybody's ideology, but sometimes the people who will engage in research will be motivated one way or another. So having all of these people in, feminists will be looking at different things to social conservatives to trans activists, but between them there is evidence-based research that will come from this. And if we can, my main goal, I think, is to help organizations resist being captured by one ideology. And what I see the situation at the moment to be is that there are people who exist who say they experience their gender as different to their sex, and that when young people are doing this, they need a evidence-based, rigorous research that will treat them as an individual and will look at why they are feeling that way and help them to come to the right decision for themselves when they are of an age to do so. And ideologues get in the way of that.
I think that is important for the new mandate. I mean, they've changed their mandate over time. Originally, they were representing the interests of parents, and now they are interested in taking on WPATH and being a valid alternative to WPATH that is evidence-based. And the problem that's happened with WPATH is institutional capture, that it almost entirely represents the queer theory interests and excludes anyone else, to the degree that they're starting to throw trans people themselves under the bus if we don't agree with queer theory. Erin Terrell, for example, was removed from a WPATH conference. And so I do think that's important if we're going to create an alternative to WPATH, that it tries to be as free of conflict of interest as possible and looking at the science, at conducting new science or analyzing existing science. Is we don't want to replace an ideologically captured institution with another equally ideologically captured institution, just another ideology.
Yes, I mean I don't I you may well know better than I do. I don't know if Genspect's aim is to replace WPATH as such, but whether it is or not, it certainly is essential that anything that pushes back at a gender ideology is not dominated by another gender ideology.
One of the things that I've found disappointing, I mean, there are a number of different, warring factions or different worldviews at the table battling this out in public, and especially on Twitter, which can get quite heated and angry and abusive at times. One of the things I find disappointing is that those different warring factions are pushing for their own agenda and their own interests, which we would expect. But n very few of them are coming to the table saying, this is how we've contributed to the problem. So, when speaking about gender dysphoria specifically, I don't think it's a coincidence how many of our transsexual guests have come on to our show to talk to us who come from very conservative Christian backgrounds. and the ways in which our conservative Christian backgrounds probably was a factor in the development of our gender dysphoria. And likewise, radical feminists are at the table pushing for change, but not taking ownership of the fact that how they treated butches within lesbianism, for example, was a factor in why many butch lesbians transitioned. So if we're not coming to the table owning those pieces, we're not really solving the core root problems.
Yes, I can see that that would certainly be true, and be true in every situation when something has gone wrong. Those advocates within that field do need to look at not only how their enemies have brought this about, but how they themselves could have contributed to it. But if we're looking at the issue of gender dysphoria or gender distress, then I think that that's one of the things that really, because it can have such a number of causes and ideological bias, experience sort of pressure to be pushed one way or another is certainly part of it. I would agree with you, Erin, that is something that would be extremely useful to look at when you're looking at the social causes of it, not just contagion and it being a fad. There's certainly more elements to it. I haven't given a great deal of thought to how radical feminists and social conservatives could address their own complicity in that. So I will at this point just say I think you're absolutely right, and that is something that needs to be discussed.
We've seen quite a bit of pushback on you on Twitter in recent years or recent weeks because of the announcement that you're now connected with Genspect as an advisor. Where would you say most of the pushback is coming from? Is that coming? Have you had a lot of pushback from the queer theorists? Or where else is that pushback coming from?
It's coming because my stance is liberal. I am regarded as suspicious by anybody who is illiberal. And if you have American or Canadian audiences, I should say by liberal, I am talking about that central principle of letting people believe, speak, live as they see fit, provided it doesn't harm anyone else or stop them from doing the same. So, because I come from this perspective, the people who come back at me are coming from a perspective where they don't want people to believe, speak, live as they see fit, providing it doesn't hurt anybody else. So, yes, so I have a cold. I have the trans activists coming at me because they don't want me to support the right of gender critical feminists to be able to disbelieve in gender identity, to say that they don't have a gender identity, that they have conscientious objection to gender identity, or the wider the public to say there are situations in which trans women cannot be straightforwardly accepted as women for reasons of safety and fairness. So because I support people arguing for this, that's when the trans activists come at me because they would like to silence the people who argue for this. The gender essentialists, the social conservatives come at me for being a degenerate because I essentially want people sort of anywhere on that LGBTQI to spectrum to be able to live as they see fit and not to be moralized about, provided again that this does not interfere with anybody else's liberty or harm anybody else. They see that as a far too permissive attitude, in which I'm kind of anything goes as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. They want to put much stricter regulations, so they've come into a kind of alliance with the gender criticals. Because they both have a problem with the trans activists, but whereas the gender criticals want to abolish gender entirely, along with gender identity, gender stereotypes, and gender roles, the social conservatives want to keep gender, tie it more strictly to sex, and then police that. So they will come at me when I disagree with that. The gender criticals will come at me for a similar reason to the social conservatives, in that I don't want to actually stop any adult from identifying as trans and living as such, and they see this as a half measure, and so I then get accused of believing in true trans and supporting autogynephiles, and because I simply don't think that it's anybody else's business who is wearing what, who is using which words, and who is identifying as what, provided we can put into place those barriers which impinge upon material reality that affects particularly women and children. So they're seen, I'm seen as half measures for all of them, and then they all focus on the half in which I don't agree with them. And the people that I want to be able to speak and live as they see fit, who they don't, and this obviously varies, the gender identity queer theorists that want to silence the gender critical feminists and the social conservatives. The social conservatives want to silence the queer theorists and the liberals, and the gender criticals want to silence the queer theorists, the trans activists, the liberals, and anybody who disagrees with them. And I'm kind of in the middle saying, remember, I really think people should be able to live as they see fit, provided they're not hurting anyone else. Can we please keep that line there? And it's people who don't want to keep that line there that who will come after me and do so in very similar ways. I'm under no misapprehension that I am not extremely fat and ugly now.
They're so vile, and they can just, yeah, people can just turn to such dirty, yeah, dirty means of engagement when they feel, yeah, feel threatened or whatever. But yeah, you're in the line of fire, kind of, yeah, pretty constantly. One thing I wanted to add, I'm going to read a little bit from the queer theory chapter of your book, just because I think that there's maybe not a fourth gender theory, but there is a another facet of this population that's transitioning that you account for, or you don't actually talk about the population, but this idea. So, to queer allows someone to be simultaneously male, female, or neither, to present as masculine, feminine, neuter, or any mixture of the three, and to adopt any sexuality, and to change any of these identities at any time, or to deny that they mean anything in the first place. This is not merely a means to individual expression, but also a political statement about the socially constructed realities, in quotes, of sex, gender, and sexuality. And then a little later on down the page, to queer something is to cast doubt upon its stability, to disrupt seemingly fixed categories, and to problematize any binaries within it. So what I've seen over the last few years, and I'm sure Aaron has as well, and you probably have too, but it seems like now there is a new class of trans people whose transition is merely to physically embody this belief system. So they are queering their bodies as a testament to this worldview, essentially. It's not so much that they want to change their sex at all. They don't want to be the opposite sex. They want to queer the binary by androgenizing their appearance in some manner. You see a lot with these kind of typically feminine heterosexual girls and women who are taking testosterone, but then continuing to dress quite femininely because that's what they feel comfortable doing, but they feel like they're complicit in the gender binary if they're doing that in their natural state. So if they take testosterone, then they've done the gender fuckery that is the that you know th that they feel morally obligated to do. And unfortunately, the people in the clinics treating them are completely oblivious to this kind of worldview, and that young people are committing their bodies to it. I'm not something that that's something that you kind of have thought much about or kind of observed. But I feel like that's a distinct class from people who believe that they have a gender identity internally that is paramount to their biology. So that's kind of what we understand as the gender theory you're describing there. But I feel like this is a distinct class of people who are literally their transition is a dedication to queer theory, essentially.
I think that's yes, a good summary of a cultural difference that we are seeing right now, because the sort of a typical stance taken by transsexuals over the last few decades has been what you describe this in a conviction of wrongness with this body and identification with some with the other, and then sort of making changes and identifications in of quite a solid kind of a shifting of categories with at least part of oneself, whereas we are seeing now this kind of embrace of fluidity and indeterminacy and androgyny as much more of a political statement. And I think this is where we see a clash as well, because a lot of these individuals seem to think that this is a matter of choice. It's not an expression necessarily of anything fixed within oneself, but it is a celebration of queering as that process to break down boundaries and roam wherever as a political statement, as a form of self-expression. And this, I think it's this contingent who are claiming that it is transphobic, for example, if a gay man does not find himself attracted to a trans man, or a trans woman who has a penis is not a source of attraction to your typical lesbian, who is defined by not being attracted to those. This is that kind of that gender fuckery, which I'm sorry, but that is the term in the scholarship, as Aaron clearly knows. Not just being gratuitously vulgar here. Gender fucking, that is a kind of political action. Then to be queer in that sense is to really embrace that the fluidity, ambiguity, the multitudes of it as a political statement in quite an authoritarian way, because of course there isn't an alternative understanding of queer, which we see from outlets. It's like Queer Majority, whom I'm a particular fan of, who are saying, okay, the queer is just anybody who doesn't fit into this sort of monogamous heterosexual thing, and that is perfectly fine. You don't have to be, and you mustn't be, in fact, authoritarian about it, or try to own it, or try to push it on anyone else. This is just an acceptance of difference, and that I think that definition of queer is a healthy one, which is not performative. It's still coming from an authentic place. Where you're not fitting into these boxes, and you don't actually have to. You can be an individual, and it really doesn't need justifying or moralizing about. But this queer theory sense of queer, in which it is a political statement to present yourself in a more masculine way, in some ways, in another, to change your pronouns on a sort of daily basis. And this is, I think, a political challenge to those categories, which does fit extremely neatly with the driving force of queer theory.
Within the medical system, one of the things that I found very disturbing when I started doing gender-affirming care was the degree of queer theory capture amongst clinicians, and just the in some cases, just the rather blind willfulness of clinicians to facilitate this political identity and embodiment by introducing new medical interventions, like mastectomies and not reattaching any nipple grafts. Which creates a very unnatural, abnormal appearing state. It's not a human state anymore, or nullification surgeries, or I've heard physicians talk about, that particular cohort not wanting to take estrogen or testosterone, but not really embody anything that appears like the opposite sex, and clinicians talking about, well, we'll give you a little bit of this and a little bit of this, and we'll start you on testosterone, and then we can always switch you back to estrogen, and really messing with people's bodies and using medicine as a way of facilitating a political movement.
I think certainly, and again, in treatment of gender distress is not something I have qualifications credentials in, but I think it should be clear that if an individual's description of their sense of gender identity and why they are wanting to make changes to their body is so clearly politically motivated, then this is should be considered a social issue, a cultural issue, and it should surely be addressed in that way. I mean, an argument could be made that adults should be free to do whatever they want politically, and I think you could make that argument, but that isn't what we're looking at really when it comes down to people who are seeking medical treatment from professionals that they should be able to trust to advise them appropriately to whatever their particular where their particular the feelings are coming from. So if something like autism is a part of this, then we need people to be able to look at neurology. If it is a situation in which a young person is coming to terms with their sexuality and they're still working through that, this is where we need to look at that kind of approach as well. Are you gay? Are you understanding this in terms of gender? Where are you in your exploration of this? If people, which has quite clearly been happening, has been documented many, many times, you will know of more cases than I do, pushing everybody into the you experience speaking of this experience of gender identity in any way at all, even with clear signs of neurological, sexological, psychological, sociological issues going on around them, we funnel you all through a transition, affirmation and transition process, then this is quite clearly inadequate to the point of being dangerous and irresponsible.
Going
Sounds
back
like you're
to
advocating for conversion therapy. Yeah. Sorry, go
going
on.
back to the point of the pushback that you've been receiving, I mean, it seems like only 10 minutes ago that we were able to have rational conversations about these things and allow space for other people. Why do you think, because we've seen a rise in very coercive and abusive tactics amongst all of these different interest groups, why do you think things have become so polarized and abusive?
I think we have been escalating for some time politically, generally, and this is very much particularly the case in the United States and when it comes to gender in Canada. But this sort of general political polarization, which people like Jonathan Haidt have been looking at for over, over a decade in the writing that I've read, and long before that. I think as well that within gender critical versus gender identity versus gender conservative, that there is this, that it has always been conducted in a way in which there was going to have to be a clash and one would have to smash the other out. So I have this rather strange concept of how how one idea can beat the other, and I describe this as the best way that this can do this is like sponges. So you have the sponges in the box of something. So you could have a liberal approach, a gender identity approach, a gender essentialist approach, gender critical approach, and as people become more convinced by arguments from one or the other, one of the sponges takes on water, it gets bigger, and it dries out the other, and it pushes them out. And this is how bad ideas are generally best beaten, when this organic sort of swell of acceptance for one set of ideas and discrediting of another happens. But this isn't what is happening with the battle, particularly between radical feminists and trans activists, because they have come at it straight from an all or nothing standpoint. First of all, there has not been any any chance of working things out. Where liberal feminists like me, that was how I first came on the scene, trying to say, okay, so protecting women's spaces and sports is non-negotiable. However, trans people are still getting a lot of abuse. So can we perhaps have third spaces, bathrooms, changing rooms for them? Can we have an agreement that it's not okay to yell abuse at them in the street, and this won't actually affect women's spaces? But and trying to that there are a conflict of interest there, and trying to resolve that so that no, with this, in a way that isn't a compromise, so nobody loses any rights, has been the aim of liberals. But the more radical feminists and the trans activists have just sort of come straight on with the insistence that the other must not exist at all. And when you're coming at that in that way, there cannot be any kind of organic growth towards one idea, any kind of resolution. It just goes into an existential polarizing spin and escalates with one side. So, well, you're just misogynist, you're just transphobes. Nobody's actually hearing the other, and the intention is just to smash the other out of existence. And so that was a really long-winded and waffly answer to that question.
It's a great answer.
So you just finished a new book. You want to talk about that? What's that about?
The Counterweight Handbook. Yes, yeah, so that was when in 2020, just after the Black Lives Matter protests, when a lot of workplaces started taking on these new DEI policies and training programs that focus mostly on race and but to a significant extent on gender as well, and then to a lesser extent on sexism, ableism, fat phobia. And this was also rising in universities and it was coming into schools. I started getting hundreds of emails a day from people who were having to affirm their own racism, or pretend to have a gender identity. Some of my colleagues were getting thousands of these a day. I started pouring everybody into a Discord server, and I was trying to triage emergencies, helping people to write letters, find the information they needed. And then I was joined by my friend Carrie Clark, who's the most amazing logistical brain in the world. And she started collating problems, writing pathways, finding guidance. And we essentially formed a system that we called Counterweight, an organization which ended up having 12, 25 people in the end, in which we were helping people in all areas to try to come together and push back authoritarian critical social justice in their workplace, in their university, in their school. I mean, we were dealing with about 100 cases a month until my brain exploded. But and now I'm generally advising organizations on avoiding ideological capture. So that's the same kind of thing. But Counterweight, it's a very practical thing. It's aimed at primarily at blue and white collar workers, who are the majority of people that we had. It sort of covers what is critical social justice, including the particularly contemporary critical theories of race and queer theory inspired trans activism and imperialism. What is this? What do they really believe? How does it work? What is unconscious bias training, DEI? Does that work? And it breaks down those, and then it helps people how to assess whether your organization is having this kind of problem, how to assess your own ability to push back at it, your security within the place, your skill set, your personality, what to do. And so it's giving a lot of practical advice of how to see if you're having this kind of problem, how to understand the problem, and how to push back at it. So I argue that it needs to come from a place of knowledge, firstly, and of principle. So I'm sort of encouraging people to understand what this ideology is, and also to think through their own principles in objection to it, because it seems so obvious, of course, that you just say, well, I don't want to pretend to have a gender identity. I don't want to claim to be racist. What I want to have my own mind. What the hell are you doing? But you sort of, and for liberals in particular, we just haven't had to think through why it is a good thing for people to be able to have their own beliefs and use their own speech, and why we should let people oppose discrimination and prejudice from their own ethical standpoint, which most ethical standpoints do. Workplaces, of course, have the right to say we will not have prejudice and discrimination exhibited here, but they don't have the right to say you have to do it through this theory. You can do it from any range, and workplaces do not have the right to say you must take on this conception of invisible power and privilege dynamics running through everything in very specific ways. They just don't. No more than they have the right to say you must affirm that Jesus is the Son of God before you start working here. So I'm waffling again. So this is what Counterweight has done, and the book essentially sort of breaks down the problem and helps people to kind of articulate their own principled, knowledgeable responses. There's a lot of template letters in there. There's case studies, there's descriptions of the different kinds of problems that you will find, the buzzword waffler, the problematizer, and how to deal with it. And then it can concludes by considering that the wokeness, as they call it, is seems to be declining. Not enough, not in Canada, I'm afraid,
We're hopeless.
but the evidence that it is, and how we need to, not get complacent about that, that how to see it out and how to get liberal policies of it into place rather than counter-authoritarianism. So yes, that's the new book.
Sounds
Sounds
forward to
great.
reading it. Well, thank you so much,
Well,
Helen, for
thank you.
coming and talking to us. It's been a great conversation.
No, it was lovely to meet you both, Erin, and it was a good chat.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Transparency Podcast. If you enjoy our content, please help out our algorithm by hitting like or subscribe. If you'd like to make a donation, follow the link to our PayPal account. On behalf of the Gender Dysphoria Alliance, thanks for your support.